Hello, welcome everybody to an In Conversation podcast with
Anne-Marie Nicoran. I'm a poet and editor from Donegal in Northwest Ireland, and I am the author of two collections of poetry, Bloodroot from Dura Press in 2017, and The Poison Glen, which is published by the Gallery Press in 2021.
in this podcast, we're are discussing the role of Instagram, but also poet in the making of poetry, in the writing of poetry, and how we share as readers those that imagination, those words, and what that evokes for us. To do that, we're discussing with Anne-Marie Nicoran, a well-known poet from Ireland, writing, and she'll no doubt talk a little bit more about her work. And I'm Bridget Wessels. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Glasgow. And we're both working on a project called C21 Editions, which is really a project that's looking at born digital data, as well as, older literature such as Chaucer, and how we engage with that literature through the digital means, but also through our established ways of reading and speaking poetry and plays and so on and so forth. So to start off with, Anne-Marie, would you like to talk a little bit about your how you came into writing and what sort of triggered your imagination, your journey into writing?
Sure. Well, I suppose that my work is greatly influenced by the landscape that I grew up in. So I grew up in Northwest Donegal in Ireland in Gaeltacht, the area. And a Gaeltacht, the area, is a geographical pocket where the Irish language is spoken every day and where there is a very vibrant native culture of storytelling, song, dancing, but also folklore, legend, and myth. So I suppose it was a gift to me to that I had the experience of growing up there and that I had exposure, I suppose, to imaginative ways of thinking and creativity. And I'm quite sure that that is part of the reason why I felt like I belonged in story and storytelling.
I think that's quite interesting because I guess my history briefly is that my father's Dutch, my mother's English, and I was born in the Channel Islands in Guernsey. And sort of up till I was about 11, I was kind of living in Netherlands, in the Netherlands for part of the time, and in England for another part of the time. So it was always fitting in and understanding the other in a particular way, and recognizing that my friends' personal experiences were shaped by where they grew up. And some of that was quite imaginative. So my English parents came from Robin Hood's Bay, which was an old smugglers' village, on facing the North Sea, and it had lots of myths and characters, and there was that oral history there. And then, of course, the Dutch was very flat, big skies, and again, their imagination in terms of reclaiming the land and that kind of narrative. So it was shifting between those two. Really understanding how personal experience was shaped culturally and the way it was told. And I think that's why I've always been really interested in writing, in poetry, in storying, but also in the reader's experience, what they bring to that storying and that relationship with a text or with a particular story. So I think there's kind of shared links there in some kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel that being bilingual and the fact that English is not my first language, and that I only learned that when I went to school, all of that also gave me a kind of sensitivity for language and sound and playing with words and wordplay and inventing and experimentation with language. So I think a lot of your early life goes into the mix of what makes a writer, and a lot of writers and poets maybe in particular will also cite the role of elders or grandparents or people who in their lives who have the time to give stories. And I was very fortunate in that regard as well. I had a grandmother who had lots of time on her hands to spend with me and to gift me stories and superstitions and kind of little rituals. And she was always making potions or cursing somebody or she was part of a era as well where you're quite comfortable spending time imaginatively and not wired to a device, but being in the company of others and telling stories. So all of that was hugely influential.
I think that's really interesting because I'm obviously the bilingual bit. I thought that as well. And you realize that language isn't just words and a way of saying them. It's an imaginative universe that kind of makes sense. Some can be translated and others can't. And I think like my grandparents, my English grandparents in particular, granddad was part of one of the old Bay families kind of thing. And all the stories he'd tell, and there was a little lane going up that was to Timbuktu, and goodness knows what happened there. And so that was there. And my English granny as well used to knit a lot by the fire, and I used to sit with her while she was knitting, and she'd recount stories. So I think that time with elders is quite interesting because it takes those. When you were speaking in Cork, what one of the things, a lot of things struck me was that sense of drawing on grandparents or parents. That oral tradition and that imagination. I could really hear that in your stories, and it brought me to the contemporary, I think, very, very well, I think.
And even as you're talking now, I'm thinking that, the generation that I grew up with, when I was, say, between the ages of 1 and 4, like most of the people I was around were older people. They were older than me. And now, or even around the age 3, 4, and 5, young people are in conversation or dialogue with their peers much more, because they're in conversation through dialogue. So the early influences on language were they were elders, they were older people, they were carers. And now I do look at my niece who has this wide community of peers that she's connected with. So it's certainly it's a different exposure to language that we got in the 80s, very different to what kids are being exposed to now.
Yeah, certainly sort of change. And I was kind of wondering because in one way, some of the digital world in a way gives more opportunities. There's harms and there's risks with that. And there's gains, but there's also losses from when we were probably growing up. We can remember that transition. But I think there's also something, whether it's digital or whether it's from a generation that was sort of not born digital, pre-digital. There was a sense of often, particularly I think with the written word or the spoken word, not so much with film, because film fills in a lot of the gaps for you. There's a sense of filling in the missing. There's a sense of that's really interesting, but you bring your imagination to those words, to those stories. They're still important. They shape that. And I think there's something about how do we, how, what is that relationship? Between a poet, when you're writing your poetry with your imagined readers, and your readers with you. And I kind of wondered if you've got any thoughts about how you think about that relationship, if you do at all, and whether or not I know that you do quite a lot of work on Instagram, and whether or not Instagram is part of that communication or it's part of the way in which you start to make sense of your own experience, and it's part of your writing process. I just wondered if you could. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I suppose the making of a poem, it goes through several different steps and rotations before it actually makes it onto the page. And it's at first an intuitive process. The poem, the idea for a poem crosses your mind, and it might be an image or a word or a feeling that kind of provides that initial first spark. And then the poem might go down onto the page in a first draft and might sit for a while, or the spark for a poem might cause you to want to go and visit a site or do a bit of research, but it kind of gradually, spills out onto the page, and then it sits on the page for a long time. And in the very first instance, that's intuitive, it's instinctive. I'm just following my nose, and I'm really purely just in conversation with myself, asking myself, is this a poem? Could it be a poem? Do I believe in it? Is it something that feels true and authentic? And at that stage, I'm not really thinking of who will read it, where it will end up, will it get published? Because sometimes you write poems and they don't even get published. So you're just really pulling on the threads to see if a poem is there. And then there's another step, important step, and I think of it as the technical step where the poem gets shaped and it finds its form, it gets edited, it gets tightened, distilled. And even at that stage, I'm still not thinking of a reader. I'm not thinking, what is going to happen to this poem. I'm still trying to craft it and get it right. And then it sits for a long time, and after that, there comes a point you would hope, and you think, okay, the poem is as finished as I can get it. It has in some way surprised me. It's done something unexpected, and it has a life of its own now beyond what I thought it would be. And that's always a sign for me that the poem is complete. And then, from that point, the poem may go into a journal, it might go into a magazine, it might get read at readings, it might go into a collection, it might go into an anthology alongside poems by other people. So maybe at that point, then, I'm thinking for the first time around audience and readers, and if I get an invitation from the editor of an anthology who says, would you like to provide us with a poem for this book, then I'll think, okay, well, what's the book about? Who's the readership? What poem is going to be most suitable? Or if I'm invited to read at a festival, and I might consider who the audience are and make the poetry selections for that reading based on the audience. But that kind of relationship with audience and readership really comes in at the end. It comes in once the poem is completely made. And I wonder, is that in some ways similar to, I don't know, I'm wondering, is that similar to the process with academic writing
It's
or with
funny, I can't,
non-fiction?
yeah, it is often, it's, you're kind of with it, you're within a community in a shared language that,
Yeah.
there's different people will have different forms, but you've got a germ of an idea and you kind of work with that, and then you kind of work that up, and there's lots of drafts and iterations and that honing and that polishing, whether it's a book, a journal article, or a research proposal. Because somehow then that's when you're trying to communicate those ideas. And I think we tend to work more, I think, with the reader because we're very aware of our peers and the peer review, and it's so I think there's more than that, but nonetheless, I think there still is that sense of your idea, your contribution to the conversation. So I think it's both your contribution and trusting and judging that. And like you kind of, is it, does it work as a piece of text or as an argument? And again, it can feel a bit, little bit, you can be anxious around it because does it make sense? Do other people see value in this? And so yes, there is, it's a very, very similar process, I think. And I think there's something around a writer's journey, as you're working through, the way in which you develop a style, themes that you're wanting to address, those come through in different ways. Sometimes emphasize one thing gets more emphasized than another, but you're taking different lenses through slices of life. And I think that's where your poetry is really great because you've got some really key themes that you talk about, land, the state, religion, gender, and so on. And but you take different lenses and you write about them in from different perspectives in different ways, I think evoking the complexity of those experiences, I think.
Yeah, and to go back to your question about Instagram or social media and what where that comes in on that journey of discovery and making a poem. I think because I have written extensively about the lives of women and children over the last 100 years in Ireland, and because I've been exploring the silences and the invisibility around those lives, that Instagram has been a really interesting space for me to create awareness about the work, in the same way that I feel that type of work also deserves to be read aloud because it allows an audience to get an embodied feeling for those poems and the subjects of those poems. And it often feels to me that I'm honoring the mothers and children whose lives were obscured with a public reading. There's something as well about engaging with public space and public platforms to create awareness around these stories. Now, I often don't put poetry into social media spaces because I really invite the readers to, to read the poems in the context of a book, or to make the commitment of buying a printed book. But I do think Instagram has been a really interesting space to just create context for my books, and to engage with audiences, in a different way, engage them in the stories behind the books, and to create awareness that these poetry books have been written as well. The other thing that's really interesting for me is that a lot of my poems have, in some ways, engaged with research. So if I'm writing about, the mother and baby homes, for example, that's a story that's very personal to me. My family have a connection with the mother and baby homes, but I'm also often reading reports or documents. And if I'm going to the site of a mother and baby home, and if I post a picture on Instagram of a particular site, I will get comments and feedback and engagement from followers on Instagram that helps contextualize both my own family story and also the research that I have engaged with. So it gives me this other third kind of layer of community engagement. And sometimes I'll take a picture of somewhere I want to write about, or a site or a building or a ruin, and I'll put it on Instagram and I'll just let it sit, and I will watch the dialogue or conversation around that picture unfold. And then that becomes part, that enters my consciousness, it enters my kind of imagination, and becomes fused then with my own instinctive wanderings and the research that I've read, that it all goes into this kind of, making of a poem as well. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's really interesting because often a lot of the work says it's, it's online, or books are dead, or people aren't going to be online, they don't trust it. But I think the way in which we engage with different kinds of sources, whether it's grandparents, whether it's our friends at school, whether it's books and it's online, but we bring the together those almost fragments. But then I think within a poem, it almost condenses that experience and that understanding into one kind of piece of art, I guess, piece of craft, piece of storytelling. And I think it's really interesting that what you've said so beautifully is that Instagram is there, and it's a way of sort of thinking through and getting ideas, sharing that with other people, looking at what's coming back, but then still that notion of the book, the codex, the printed word, the public reading, in a way, all of those sit together in the ways in which you're writing your poetry, in the ways in which you want people to engage with your poetry, I think.
I also really enjoy the aesthetic of Instagram. It looks and feels very different to other types of social media tools. And when I was a child, in national school, every Wednesday afternoon we had to cut out these little squares of newspaper, and then we cut out squares of cloth to match them. and we had to sew the a square of patchwork, and the learning of it was, how to make stitches, how to fit patchwork squares together. And even though it was sometimes for a child monotonous work, also the challenge was to make each square interesting, by choosing different fabrics and choosing different patterns. And in a way, Instagram is kind of like that. You've got this square, you can show an image, and the challenge is to make it vibrant. And I really enjoy the constraint of that as a writer. It kind of helps exercise that muscle. You've got a parameter here, but within that parameter, what can you do with this space?
I think that's really interesting because at one of the project workshops, we took a lot of your visuals, and there was a whole group of people from different disciplines, different experiences, and the engagement with the visuals, with the photographs in particular, people were sort of putting them into sort of clusters or saying this links with this and comparing the sky in one with the sky in the other and all the different kind of colors, the darkness and the lightness. And there was a real engagement with that visual experience, I think, that wasn't just about the visual, but took them to a particular place or a particular mood or a way of thinking. And I think it's quite interesting the way you've talked about that just now, but also about also the discipline of writing, about ordering and kind of that editing and kind of working through the art of the possible almost, I guess.
Yeah, and in my native tongue, place is really very important, and where you come from is really important. And when people greet each other, they'll ask you, who are you with? Who do you belong to? And where do you come from? Kesu agus Kalishu. Kesu, where do you come from? As Kalishu, who are you belonged with? And you'll find that in a lot of native languages. Recently, I was in conversation with the Mojave poet Natalie Diaz, and she spoke about how in the Mojave language, it's always really important to say where you're coming, where you've come from, so that people can understand how you've arrived. And again, going back to Instagram, it al really allows me to show people where I've come from, where I'm coming from, and this is how I'm arriving, and it is such a great tool for showing landscape and for giving that I suppose picture that is so feels so natural to me, to like it's in many ways it feels much more natural than Twitter, which is not set up primarily. I mean, you can share pictures, but it's not where the focus is at, So yeah, there's something about Instagram that feels very natural to the world that I grew up in, much more so than other social media tools.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because to kind of broaden it out, if we think, of I often say where I'm coming from, I'm half Dutch, because I kind of feel I need to let people know. But I think something also, if we let people know where we're coming from, where we are and where we're going to, kind of thing, there's a sense of opening that space in the public sphere for an openness, for welcoming the other, for inviting the other into your universe, but also then their universe into yours. So we see ourselves in the other. And I think, given we're in quite a fractured, quite conflictual time at the moment, I think maintaining that openness when, we're seeing the rise of kind of far right economic austerity and issues where people can often retract, I think the role of keeping that openness and sharing that experience is important. And I think what you seem to be saying is that Instagram, as a tool out of all the social media, is most helpful for you in that space because it's an open space, it's an invitation space, it's a space that shares land and landscape in a way and experience, whereas the others can often close down and become kind of filter bubbles, and
Mm.
often, you know, like-minded people talk to like-minded people, and it becomes a space that's restrictive and not progressive. And so I think there's something really interesting in the way you're talking about that, and but then how that relates to your poetry, I think is.
I mean, it's really interesting now to look back over my Instagram and to look at the images of that relating to that time when we were in COVID and when we were in lockdown. And I think they, like, I can almost pick them out at a glance as being distinct from the images that were created before and after COVID. And I think, you know, listen, there's an element of performance in all of our online lives, you know, that can't be denied. It's just the nature of the tool and the nature of humans. But there is an authenticity there as well. I mean, a picture will often tell a kind of truth and that can't be escaped. And so even though we're still all performing our lives online during lockdowns and during COVID, you can clearly see, you know, our engagement with space was hugely impacted. You know, looking over those images now, there seems to be this kind of scent of loneliness, you know, in how the pictures are framed and who's in them, and they but also the engagement with landscape is quite deep and meaningful as well. So there's like a stillness around those particular images that I think, wow, you know, you don't realize when you're in the moment how, well, I didn't realize when I was in that moment how my way of looking, my window into the world and my window out was so impacted. But clearly the evidence is now is there online. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. It's almost a time that was frozen. I don't think it's only now that we can look back and see how that was different. And a colleague of mine just, you know, talked about looking through in Glasgow. There was a set of poets, working class poets, who talked about windows and that window through into the city, to their environment. And some of my colleagues working, you know, in that tradition with that group. There was a sense of those that narrative and that idea about the window and looking out during lockdown became that theme came back again. I think it was quite interesting. So yeah, I think that's really great. And I just kind of we touched on a number of things, but I would really love it if you could finish with a poetry reading. And I think for me, you know, listening when you came to court, listening to your poetry, I was kind of, you seemed to touch on the invisible, but on what was missing and verbalize the missing that I think touched a number of people in the audience. And I just wondered if you would read The Daughter Who Went Missing for us, if that's.
Sure, I'd just be delighted to. The daughter who went missing. If I were to tell you that a vigil was held, candles lit, prayers said, or that long beams of silver torchlight scanned the village in search, or that the river bailiff soaked by rain was forced to plead with the villagers, somebody must know something. I would be lying. Quietly, darkness fell upon railway tracks, outhouses, derelict sheds, upon an empty nest curled into a leafless oak, upon a foothold trap shimmering in the forest like a buried star. As all night the river kept rising, the mess, the end unstirred. And outside the house of the missing girl, a black raven called, traitors, traitors, traitors.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie. I think that's such a poem that kind of talks about the missing and where that missing might be, and then the silences around that, both in a very material way, but also I think something that many of us experience in our everyday lives. So thank you very much. Is there anything else that you want to add, or do you feel?
No, just I want to say thank you for your really important work. I think this is a fascinating question. How do writers and poets poets in particular, I'm really interested in how do they use so social media and why. And I mean that the learning of this, I mean, Instagram was first founded, or was first, I first became aware of it anywhere around 2010, 2011. And you know, in over a decade of using it, it's revealed its uses to me slowly. But one of the things I've been thinking about is how we're reimagining you know, all of the hierarchies of the art and literary worlds, and how this has been a tool for reimagining and dismantling and creating community, I suppose, and kind of opening out the tradition of literature in Ireland for the types of poets and voices that would historically have been excluded or pushed to the sides or, you know, just not heard. So oftentimes social media gets this very bad rap, and of course, like a million other devices, if used incorrectly, they can suck up time, suck up energy, cause conflict. But, you know, can also have this role of helping us cultivate more diverse spaces and inclusive spaces.
I mean, I think, and certainly Tim Berners-Lee, who actually invented the World Wide Web, his idea was quite a utopian idea. It's a democratizing tool, and he wanted people to sort of, you know, that it was less hierarchical, less institutionally bound, and that it wouldn't favor the individual over society or society over the individual, that it was an equal balance, and it was that sort of shared space for opening up discussion, understanding, and so on and so forth. But of course, we kind of know that it still does that to a degree, but it also, if not, as you say, if used incorrectly. But I do think it's a democratizing tool, and I think it is a way for different voices to be in that public space or public spheres, and people finding a voice there. But I think I still think that link, as you say, with the book, with public readings, using it as part of a whole set of resources about how we engaged with poetry, literature, art in whatever form. It's that kind of different kinds of engagement. And certainly working with the Courtauld, they were very sort of strong on what they would call active viewing. And I think it's that active engagement with a text of whatever type is what people find fulfilling, I think, and that's your gift to us. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for your research. Yeah, it's such an important thing to be thinking about, actually, because these technologies now play such a vital role in our lives. They're so central. We spend so much time, and so it's just really valuable thing to do is to reflect on why is it that how and how best can we use them, you know, to make art, to tell stories, to, yeah, be writers.